For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's great about being a mom or a parent is that my kid eats whatever I make for them. It's great, right? Their nutrition's perfect. No, says it, no mom ever, and certainly not any mom or parent in this realm specifically. I don't know a single child on the autism spectrum that has the perfect balance of nutrition and did not have any feeding challenges. So that's any indicator about the conversation we're about to have, really be excited because we have a very special guest with us and I can't wait to introduce her. So hang on.
When you become a mom, you never imagine your child getting an autism diagnosis. It feels like your dreams have shattered, like a framed photograph falling off your mantle, exploding into a thousand pieces. But instead of trying to glue those pieces back together, this community of moms is here to help you build a new dream, a better one. So join in the conversation as us moms talk autism.
So this is a common question that we get from our community at large, that everyone in some regard has questions or concerns about what their kids are eating. How do we get our kids to eat? Do we supplement? How do we manage the nutrition for our children? And honestly, if I can be candid, most of us, because we are not medical experts, we do not feel comfortable providing answers to that, because there's also not just one way to answer it. And it's actually looking at things kind of holistically. So hence cue the professional that we have on our podcast today. So here myself is Jean. I'm host today with our Tosh.
Hi.
And we have Elizabeth Klein. She is a BCBA, LBA, and MED. So she is a board certified behavioral analyst. And a licensed behavioral analyst as well. And so she actually works specifically with this population of kids, has a lot of experience and know-how in this. And aside from that, she, through working in this field, she was finding that there was basically a ceiling, or there was a way that we weren't really solving the problem or remedying the eating habits and nutritional standards for our kids on the spectrum. So she created an assessment tool that she's going to tell us all about and we're going to talk about and geek out about today. And on the side of that, she also has a nutrition business that she runs with her husband. So she is a boundless amounts of wisdom, institutional wisdom when it comes to this. And we're so proud to have her on. And I'm going to turn it over to her so she can tell us even more innately a little bit about herself. And then we're going to dive into all of the nitty gritty about the tool, how it can be helpful and how to access it. And even our own personally lived experiences, because you know, you never are going to get off an episode here without hearing from any of us moms who are currently on the struggle bus with their kids' nutrition and eating habits, or any of our habits or any of our topics. You know that doesn't happen. So you can anticipate that for sure. So Elizabeth, go ahead. Thanks for being here with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's really exciting and it's an honor to get to talk about all of this. Like you said, I've worked with children and adults with autism as well as other disabilities for a very long time. I started working with them in high school. I volunteered at a summer camp, and it was just from then on, I knew that was what I was passionate about and that I really wanted to serve that population. Since then, I went into college and pursued, I started at social work and then I decided to switch to special education. I did do sometimes a special education teacher. So I'm familiar with this struggle in the school building as well. And then I was a regular education teacher too. And then I worked with this population in a variety of other contexts. I did residential care. I've done music therapy. I've done nonprofit work. I've worked with young adults to integrate them into more of like a social setting. So just tons of different things in addition to ultimately becoming a BCBA. And so working, you know, doing ABA therapy in clinic, home, school, and community settings. And just regardless of whatever setting I worked in, whatever clientele I served consistently, there were feeding issues. I like exactly like you said, I rarely, if ever, came across a parent who was like, I'm completely happy with the way my child eats. So even if it was, you know, minor things or very severe things, there was never just a, you know, we don't have to deal with feeding problems at all. So I was seeing this big gap and lack of resources, especially for those that are typically described as more high functioning. You know, if they don't have swallowing deficits, if they don't have oral motor deficits, if they just won't eat and there's not really a reason why, there wasn't really a place to turn. And so that kind of led me to developing the feeding assessment tool. And like you said, my husband and I are also just passionate about healthy eating. And we do own a nutrition store as well, where we help, you know, the typical population with their health too. But yeah, I just continued to find that children with autism were struggling with eating, and that is such a root cause of so many other behavior problems, so much family dysfunction, you know, not being able to perform well in their other therapies. And that's just, it's one of the main behaviors that needs to be targeted.
I totally agree. I think when in other previous discussions that we had with you, I even had mentioned, because we have personally walked through other feeding programs through ABA, as well as through our speech and occupational therapy programs. We even at one point had all three working together on the same feeding program that was evidence-based, and it was working really well. Until it wasn't. And the thing that threw it off wasn't how the scaffolding of the program itself. It was that the clinician that then started to come in to oversee from the ABA practice meddled, intervened, didn't like it, was trying to covertly influence me to move to a different model. And by doing so, interrupted that and actually caused my child to have a traumatic experience. And now we've never been able to get back on the right track. Mm-hmm. I had to move into a program called ISCA, which was the My Way protocol, was to even help him recover from that so he could even start to trust me and his clinicians and behavioral technicians, even around like anything regarding food, right? It wasn't just food, it helped everything broadly, but just from that perspective, that, you know, we're still not out of the gate. I think what's happening now to our advantage is because my child is approaching adolescence, and obviously their physiology, our kid's physiology and maturation has impacts this as well, is that he's hungrier, right? And she's like, well, I do want to eat more food. This means I'm also going to, he's starting to have his own curiosities, but I'm not placing the demands. And I certainly would never revert back to any of those old things, but anything that even reflects those types of protocols outside of, again, the My Way protocol is like immediately like shut down for him. You know, he's demand avoidant. It's just not going to happen. And we can't even work through that to get through to that piece. And I think a lot of parents end up there, and we've done everything, like trying to throw everything at it, the kitchen sink, right? We tried food program that was also created by BCBA called Ate the Plate, which I was very optimistic about and loved. And my daughter was loving it. because we were, I was trying to make it like universal at home. Mm-hmm. It's because it's not, these things don't have to just be targeted to our kids on the spectrum. It can be all kids, right? I think it's also kind of how you even can manage if something is like really autonomously, you know, an agreement with a child or, you know, wherever they are, mm-hmm. Developmentally. And like, he still was shedding it. I couldn't do it. And it was almost even like environmental things, like just not even wanting to sit at the table because of it at home. He will not sit at our kitchen table. I can literally still count on my hands since the time we've lived in Texas, which is 8 years, that he has sat at the kitchen table and eat. Mm-hmm. So, and I've just let it go. It's like not even a thing for me, but I like anymore. But maybe if I start digging, it is kind of a thing, and it would be nice because there's such nostalgia. I mean, I have a culinary background, and I know food is just even from a communal standpoint, mm-hmm. and a cultural standpoint, it's a thing that universally brings people together. Mm-hmm. And so you start to lose that piece, and there's like grief around it. I think even mm-hmm. as a parent, it's this very complicated, nuanced manner. It's not just the focus on the nutritional element to your child, which is the driving factor. You're kind of, I mean, I was over functioning, trying so hard to be like, oh, I need you to get to eat. I need you to eat. I need you to eat. I had such a deep rooted belief that, you know, food was nutrition. That was, food was health. Food was medicine. And I'm like, I had to let go of all that, right? He's my beige food warrior, all different variations of beige. That's mm-hmm. where we're at still, you know, mm-hmm. maybe pizza, there's red sauce in it. Mm-hmm. But that is basically the color palette, and that's mm-hmm. not my own thing. And I think that was a huge let go for me. I know it's a huge hang up, especially as a parent. Let's even just bring it up to the bar of just being moms, especially now. You can't mm-hmm. open up social media, any of them, without parent putting together these most elaborate things like, oh, look at all this stuff you can make for your kid. And I'm just like laughing because I'm like, my kid ain't going to eat that. My kid, my kid doesn't eat that. I'm not even going to invest the time, currency, and even trying that, even if I wanted to. You know, there's so much that I'm like, well, that's nice to look at. And I'm just like thinking, can I also see your kid eating it? Mm-hmm. Can I see your kid? How's that going? Right. So even on that level, it's just everywhere because it's a basic need, right? It's a huge, huge basic need. And without that basic need being met, like you said, it just rolls in into all other parts. It's unavoidable. It intersects with everything, right? How can it not, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Their mood, their sleep, everything. So tell us about, I guess, where in this journey, like what came first? Were you a BCBA first? And were you trying some of those programs and then you created the rubric, or you created the rubric and then you also became a BCBA?
No, I was a BCBA first. And one thing I wanted to just touch on, just since you brought it up, and I think it's so valuable, I don't want to forget to say it, is like you said, the food, you know, sitting down, eating at the table as a family, I think that's such a like refreshing, rejuvenating time. And so I think a lot of parents with children with autism don't get a whole lot of that time. And so then when the difficult things come up, you know, when you have a child who has more typical behaviors, when those difficult things come up, you kind of like lean on that. Yeah, but we had such a great time together yesterday, or we, you know, that mm-hmm. great conversation we had, like you're able to kind of get through those times. But for someone who doesn't get those refreshers and like those positive interactions during mealtime, like that can be so hard for a parent to then make it through the difficult times. There's not much to mm-hmm. like fall back on. So I just wanted to make sure I pointed that out, because I think the family piece is so important. If you're expecting, you know, this child to make progress, they need to have the parent who's able to, you know, be present with them and not just eat your food. So, right. But yes, mm-hmm. I became a BCBA, and it was something that every single child on my caseload struggled with. And I wasn't surprised, because I was like, well, yeah, every single child I've ever worked with has struggled with it. And so I started looking into resources for particularly food selectivity, because I was like, I'm not a speech pathologist, so I know there's resources out there for swallowing, oral motor. I'm not an OT. I know there's resources out there for like adaptations and things of that nature. But the children that I was working with that were receiving therapy from all three sources were still not having their food selectivity needs met, it seemed like. And the parents kept asking me questions. And I was like, it doesn't really seem like, I don't know where to point you. So that's kind of where I went into, I started seeking out training on feeding therapy, specifically in behavior analysis, and then also using an interdisciplinary approach, which I believe currently an interdisciplinary approach is really the way to go when it comes to feeding mm-hmm. treatment. I think that's the most effective. And then from there, I decided to develop something that could specifically target some more of the food selectivity piece, as well as the mealtime behaviors. So the things that I saw were lacking. So the feeding assessment tool is great because it does target both of those things. And it gives you kind of a starting point of, what foods should we actually start with? What foods should we move on to next? Rather than just kind of taking a shot in the dark and being like, let's start with applesauce, because that's not systematic. That might just be the way that practice does things, is we just start with applesauce. So I've had a lot of success with kind of learning which food is going to be best for the child to start with, kind of getting the low-hanging fruit out of the way, making some progress, gaining some momentum, and then tackling some of those more difficult things. They're always kind of surprising. Like, it's not usually just applesauce. I had one child who started with those little sausages, like those little Polska sausages. It's so random, but it worked really well based on her test results. That was what we needed to start with. So that's kind of how I went about it. And just started using it with my own clients, and then, reaching out to other clinicians as well that could benefit from it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I love it. Just really quickly, I want to say, obviously there's so much that goes around, like you had touched on earlier. Scientists are figuring out so much that the gut is connected to everything. And then, of course, like you were also saying, that because of the either lack of certain foods or protein or whatever it might be, that then there's the other behaviors that come from it, so like what maybe a lot of us, people in this community try to like pinpoint it, like, for an example, somebody will reach out to us and they'll say like, is your child eating gluten? Or is your child not eating gluten? Are they eating, are they having red dye 40 in there? There's all of these like very specific things. And again, I feel like it kind of all just goes down to each child individually, but then also like, how do you, if I brought my son Jack in to you and he has, I would say, a well-rounded diet. It's very regimen. It's the same, 25 things, but I mean, he gets, mm-hmm. Fruit, vegetables, carbs. How would that look for, like, if we walked into your office and I was like, okay, he's 10 years old, he's fourth grade. I want him to start like trying different things, just trying mm-hmm. it, where do we even begin? Mm-hmm. How does that even look? I know that may sound just so basic, but
no, yeah, definitely.
Cause it's super bizarre to me that I can, ask him casually all the time, hey, you should try this. You should try it. Doesn't matter if it's something sugary. Doesn't matter if it's something, healthy. Doesn't matter where it's at.
I still think
a different
Jack
kind of
is
meat.
Trying things, because I got to witness it twice this year. One in person and two before we got there, before we visited.
Yes. There. So, but I mean, what I've kind of come to notice is that I can ask until I'm blue in the face, right? But he randomly comes home sometimes and is like, I like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And I'm like, where did you have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? Because you haven't had one of those since you were like a little tiny toddler. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm kind of starting to notice is that in his age group, that he's in elementary and being, exposed to, lots of different kids, whatever, that he is maybe a little bit more willing to try things, but it's still such an issue at home, you know? And it really, again, it really doesn't matter what it is. Like, it could be, you know, a ridiculously delicious piece of chocolate. And he, if it's not in his wheelhouse, if it looks, you know, like, oh no, that's disgusting, mm-hmm. you know? And it's like, well, what, you eat this piece of chocolate? So what's the difference? You know,
absolutely.
So just like back to the basic of a parent like me, who's like, okay, where do I begin?
Well, and I think what you described is such a good picture of like the overall food sensory profile, because a lot of people say it's a texture issue. And sometimes it is.
I was just going to say that because like, it's not a texture issue a lot of the times with, I mean, it can mm-hmm. be, but like he eats hummus, yes. you know, like. There's adults that are typical that are like, hummus is disgusting. That has a disgusting
texture.
So, I mean, there is no, for me, rhyme or reason to what he does and doesn't like, or what he will try and won't try, and the why behind
exactly.
it.
Exactly. I'm so glad you brought that up. Because
continue on.
I'm so glad you brought that up. So that was really the goal of the assessment tool. Is the first half of it is like a super in-depth food inventory. Other food inventories out there will say, you know, does your child eat sandwiches? That doesn't really tell us anything. Ours is a really, really in-depth food inventory about the shape, the color, the texture, you know, every single food asks a wide variety. And then that way we can give a result as far as we have several different colors, textures, temperatures, shapes, flavors. So it's across the board. It's extremely robust. And that way you can see what those patterns really are, because most of the time they're not as random as they seem. You know, you might think like this piece of chocolate is the same as that piece of chocolate, but they're not. They look different, you know, they smell different, whatever it is. So this gives you a better picture of what those patterns are. And then you can look at that and say, okay, that makes sense. I need to target pink foods that are chewy. That's something I can be successful with based on, you know, what these results are, rather than just, what do you mean you don't want this chocolate? This chocolate is yummy. Try it. So it gives you much more of a systematic starting point.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Perfect example is like he eats apples. He loves apples. It's one of his favorite fruits. He likes the skin peeled off, of course. So, you know, we do that still. Sometimes he'll eat it whole. That's been a transition. But I peeled him an apple one time that was like, had like pink veins in it, almost like it, delicious. The apple was delicious, but he wouldn't even try it because it didn't look like the other mm-hmm. apples. Maybe like the Envy, the Pink Lady, the, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. It had this like weird kind of pinkish white anyways. And so I mean, it was like I had to bribe him with
Roy won't even eat his
a treat in order just
food.
To try this apple that is delicious.
Mm-hmm. He won't even eat his, you know, packaged food.
So that's
what,
I guess,
what
I'm
the packaging. Mm-hmm. So like,
so that's what's so hard for me to understand, is that I as a parent, I'm going, what? Mm-hmm. Like, you know. And then it was like, once he tried it, he was like, oh, yeah, okay, it's delicious, mm-hmm. you know? So, but your head as the parent is exploding because you're like, where do you even begin? And I realize that some of these kids are, you know, people are early on in their journey and they are in ABA, you know, we never did ABA. And so there are people that are aware of these different things, you know, and food therapies, et cetera. But like, you know, just kind of even the difference between a toddler that's diagnosed and then a, you know, school age child, you know, a child in their adolescence or whatever, like moving through that protocol of, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
sorry.
One thing
I just went on
a
tangent and I don't even know what I was asking.
No, yeah. It accounts for age groups as well, because you expect that a toddler would be more picky. I would be shocked if a toddler was like, I love asparagus, it's the bomb. So there's certain like levels of pickiness that are totally typical. But yeah, when you get to like an adolescent age or something, you'd expect to have more foods in the repertoire. It shouldn't just be chicken nuggets. So that's definitely important right. to note too, is there's normal levels of pickiness. And even in adulthood, you can dislike things. There's a normal level of preference that should, you know, be at play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I don't like my vegetables oversteamed or whatever. Yeah. Yes. But, okay. Yeah. It's just, it's ever changing. Right. I mean, you know, like Jean, you, like you've said, Rory has been on a beige diet for,
especially since two.
Forever. Amen.
Yeah, no, like he was a great eater until he was two. I mean, I could get a full range of color in him, food, vegetables, fruit.
Yes. And that's what's so bizarre to me too, is that Jack would eat fish. He was,
and then
little,
at two,
know,
it just like, fell off a cliff. And it was that same at that developmental period for us was that where the typical, mind you, for the record again, he wasn't diagnosed yet with anything, but two is that typical developmental time period where you start to see, you know, the nutrition backside, like, and their eating repertoire backside, if they were trending upwards and was well-rounded, but it is usually a short-lived period. And obviously ours wasn't a short-lived period. And what happens is the gap got bigger and bigger and bigger, and the repertoire of food that he would eat, it just got smaller and smaller and more selective. And it was like, because I was like, okay, well, he'll eat beige and orange food. Like, you know what I mean? And I'm like, well, now the orange food, like, would, it just fell off a cliff. And I'm like, I don't even know how to get that back on, you know? So,
yeah.
And again, I'm speaking in terms of color because a lot of times that helps keep it simple when people are looking at. And I always used to say, because I had a food background, and when I used to develop menus, I used to do meal planning. I used to do nutritional planning too, because I had a nutrition background. Used to say to people all the time, well, let's look at this and make sure we're eating in color. And that's how you know you have a well-rounded menu. That's one way. I won't say it's the only way, but it's definitely one big overarching way to comb out if you're eating well or your menu looks appropriate. And you can kind of fill in the gaps from there, change it or modify or whatever. But that was my wiring. And so I was like, to become unwired from that was like, what is even happening? And I'm like, and I'm such a, I can be a bulldozer, and that's probably part of the problem of why things wasn't really working really well with Rory, is that I can't hold the demand. I don't think I was backing off of the demand, because as a parent, I was panicking. He also was an extended breastfeeder. So I breastfed until he was two. I felt like, okay, my child is now not getting that additional nutritional supplementation through me. And he's got to do it on his own. I'm like panicked. Like, what is he going to do? Then boom, we get this diagnosis. And I'm thinking, there can't possibly be anything more important than his nutritional foundation here. And I was the biggest point of contention. It was my biggest stressor. For a year and a half, I feel like it was trending in the right direction. We had that interdisciplinary approach with all of the therapies working together cohesively. He was increasing his food repertoire. He was trying new things. We were even, in terms of the sensory profile, there was a lot of things that, you know, we were overcoming in that area. Even sitting at the table, there were so many things. And then it just like the rug out from underneath of you. And I think, and if you ever, you know, research and just information online, a lot of kids on the spectrum, and the other problem is that there is a lot of trauma around these therapies that are all targeted back to, you know, either poor execution of food therapy programs, and especially with the. And I want to say this, and because you're a BCBA, maybe you want to allude on this. There's a lot, or expand on it. A lot of the food therapy programs that are adopted into, you know, practice that are evidence-based, why you got to see them work, where the kid was finally eating, what was happening to a lot of these kids that are now adults, ended up with massive eating disorders mm-hmm. or disorder eating problems mm-hmm. Because they were programmed to eat a certain way and then would just, that was the only way they were doing it. And they really weren't even responding to their own autonomy. And I think that becomes the one of the challenging things as a for you as a clinician and for a parent to figure out how do we delineate what's the right pathway. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, I had shied away from a lot of those programs within ADA mm-hmm. that they wanted me to put into a treatment plan. I felt they were too aggressive because they were much more of like a, for lack of a better word, a force feeding kind of approach. And mm-hmm. or it was a total lack of access. You mm-hmm. can't have access mm-hmm. to things, and it was kind of punitive until you do this. Mm-hmm. And so there was it was kind of both. The scale went both ways, and it was like, how about neither of these options seem like the way that I want to navigate this? And it didn't seem like there was a happy medium or choice. So. Mm-hmm. So
I just have to ask, what does it even look like? You know, like I said, we've never done ABA. Mm-hmm. So what if you're somebody who's not in ABA, mm-hmm. you know, and you don't, and your child's struggling with these food situations, how do you even know who to like talk to about it? You know, maybe, of course, most of us just default to our pediatrician or whatever. But where would you even go to?
Yeah, that's a great question.
There's this whole rubrics and testing mm-hmm. and we can set up a whole plan for your child through, you know, I think there's a lot of people that just don't even know that exists.
Well, and it's still relatively young. You know, speech therapy and occupational therapy are a little bit older, but still like only 100 years old or less, as far as like when their boards were established. ABA therapy is much younger. Our board was established in 1998. And feeding therapy didn't really even come on the scene until like the early 2000s. So it's definitely still being fine-tuned. And that's why I think this is a really big, important conversation to have, because ABA sometimes gets a bad rap in general, but I think with a topic like feeding, still people are just figuring it out. Therapists are figuring it out, and the research still needs to be developed on a lot of things. But what I will say, traditionally, speech therapists are sort of the head of feeding therapy, which makes sense because they have most of the background in, you know, swallowing, myofunctional, all of that sort of thing. And then occupational therapists can be great. They have more of a background in, you know, sensory issues, adaptations, anything like that. And then BCBAs or, you know, any RBTs, ABA practitioners can be helpful if there's any sort of behavioral issue, which most of the time there is. It's not always just, you know, a sensory thing or like a physiological thing. Typically, it's like, you know, they're struggling with sitting at the table. They're struggling with whatever environmental things are going on. ABA, like I said, sometimes sort of has a reputation for being like punitive or, you know, we're just dangling a reinforcer and you have to eat this in order to get that or something. But that's really not what it is. And I think if you've had an experience like that, it's probably not the best practitioner. If you actually like look at our ethics code and things of that nature, we're not supposed to use punishment like pretty much in any circumstance, unless it's like to save a life, basically. And it shouldn't just be reinforcement either. Yes, reinforcement's important. If you're working with children, like you should be giving them high fives and telling them good job. I definitely believe that. But it's also so much more in depth than I think people realize in terms of, you know, we're doing parent training, we're doing modeling, we're doing environmental modifications. It's totally individualized and it shouldn't be this like cold thing that I think it's sometimes viewed as. But I think if you're a parent, obviously parents with autism are tasked with doing a lot of research and finding things out on their own, but you do have to figure out what's going to be best for your child based on what their needs are. So if they, you know, if they do have severe physiological needs, they have sensory issues, they're going to need adaptations, things like that, you might seek it out from an OT first. If they're really, they don't have a lot of like oral motor deficits. They don't seem to have a lot of sensory issues. And you think it is more of like a behavioral thing, then you might be fine with just a BCBA. But then, like I said, most of the time, SLPs or speech pathologists are going to be the ones who lead feeding therapy. So it's kind of based on just what you think your child needs. But then, like I said, you want to look for a team that's open to that interdisciplinary approach too, because you might start working on things and realize, oh, hey, this is a behavior problem, or this is a sensory problem, or something like that. And then you need to seek another professional, and your team needs to be okay with that.
And yeah, I think that's.
I wouldn't that's say there's ahead, other professionals that I saw the opening for that parents were pointed in direction of, and that was obviously nutritionists and dietitians, and those that then kind of were trying to niche down with those in the autism population. And so you saw, and then you saw a big biomedical movement. So you saw a lot of biomedical doctors and progressive medicine, progressive specialists step up. And the other thing, the last thing I've just seen, and this was because as a result of even conversations I had with my kids' pediatric dentists, when I said, hey, this oromotor specialist, I did an evaluation to supplement what our speech and occupational therapists were doing, which is how we stepped into the SOS feeding program. Mm-hmm. And I said, and they were speculating that he has a tongue tie in the back, which is not the anterior, posterior tongue tie. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of, they were suggesting that this is a tongue tie that goes completely under the radar, not caught often. They're not looking for it. People don't know how to identify it. So what the pediatric dentist has started doing is if they get that patient that's sitting in their chair, having issues with kind of any like feeding, swallowing, there's any kind of oral motor behavior, they partnered with a myotherapist clinic. Mm-hmm. So there's a big, especially in Austin, there seems to be a big trend with myotherapy clinics kind of opening up. And all of a sudden I started to see it and I was like, wow, this is a thing. This is great. Mm-hmm. Because they, even as pediatric dentists, weren't feeling like they were fit to identify that matter because it became very highly specialized. Mm-hmm. And they said, you know, and I wouldn't, why we're on this topic, because I know this will prompt other questions, but they said that a lot of even typical humans, because even typical humans have all kinds of lip ties, tongue ties, mm-hmm, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's common to have a posterior tongue tie. It's more common than none, but a lot of people overcome it. Again, it's just, again, working with the muscles, but some don't. And there needs to be, again, that surgical intervention that needs to occur. But it is something to potentially consider when you're like, well, why is my kid? It could also be maybe that is a reason why your kid's not eating certain textures and foods, because mm-hmm. of how their muscle mm-hmm. is able to swallow, you know, and it's not just, again, what the surface up here is telling you. Mm-hmm. And I still have conjecture around. I think that could be still a big thing for my child. His speech and articulation has like increased tremendously. There's definitely overcoming that you see, but it's still something I'm keeping an eye on. And so like those types of specialists in those groups, I would say I hear that in the circles that people get directed into. But what's also unique about your assessment tool, and we haven't mentioned this, was that it's available for anyone to use, mm-hmm. right? So even here, we're going to be able to share it on the podcast and on our page and in our community. People will be able to use that link mm-hmm. and use those assessment tools. And if I'm correct, that data obviously goes back to you, and then you can sort through it after it's aggregated, and you can have a schedule a meeting with the parent, correct? So if they want to, how does that work?
So it's open to anyone. And that's something I wanted to create too, because some people are already in feeding therapy. Some people are like, I don't know if I need it. Some people are just like tackling it on their own. And so I wanted something that is really useful for practitioners. That's, you know, speech pathologists, occupational therapists, behavior analysts, or nutritionists. but also mm-hmm. that parents could just use without any training, just to better understand their child's feeding behaviors if they want to tackle it themselves, or if they want to learn like, okay, so this is actually severe picky eating and I need to seek help, or like, no, that's actually in the normal range. It's all good. So yeah, you can definitely do it as a parent, or if you're already seeking feeding therapy, you can bring it to your therapist, whoever that is, and just request that it be done, because regardless, it's going to provide valuable information. The PDF automatically mm-hmm. generates with the results. So it's going to have like an in-depth analysis of all of the sensory factors. Like I said, that's across colors, textures, flavors, you know, all sorts of different things, food groups. So it's going to have an in-depth analysis of that. It can flag, you know, if maybe a more specific oral motor assessment needs to be completed by like an SLP or, you know, a myofunctional specialist. You can get a flag for that. And then all the behaviors that it would like recommend being worked on based on, you know, whatever age group you've selected. So, you know, it could be like, you know, if they're maybe really high functioning, it could be like eating out in a restaurant, social eating, things like that. If you're really starting at the beginning, it could just be things like picking up a fork. So it does just automatically generate that PDF. But then you can bring that to your therapist. So it doesn't have to be me. It could be whoever you work with. And that'll just provide really valuable information for the treatment plan, or just for you if you're just doing it on your own.
Yeah, just like, yeah, I mean, we aren't in any therapies outside of school mm-hmm. and we don't have any, it's not a, like an oral.
Right. They just,
what did you call it?
Oral motor.
Yeah. There's not like a, yeah. So, I mean, this would be something that we, you know, my husband and I would be kind of tackling on our own, and then maybe being able to share with, you know, like his teachers mm-hmm. and specialists at school, just to kind of to kind of, you know, support that or whatever. Yeah. But I love that. So, I mean, okay, let's do this. Sign me up.
Good.
Glad to find out. I just say that because I mean, it's, you know, like even better, I think, for somebody who is in therapies and they don't have to necessarily take it on themselves, but you know, there's probably a good amount of our community who is maybe in a very similar situation like mm-hmm. mine, you know, where we're not in those outside therapies. We're at an age where, you know, we're just trying to figure out, just trying to figure it out. Mm-hmm.
So are these live links to PDFs, or how do people access your?
So if you purchase the assessment, within 48 hours, you're going to get an individualized link for you, like your portal, basically. And then you go in, you'll complete, starts with like the initial information as far as like the age, you know, who you are, whether you're a parent, practitioner, those sorts of, mm-hmm. you know, basic things. And then the first part's going to take you through that really in-depth food inventory. So it's going to ask you specific questions about, you know, would they eat this food? How likely is it they would eat this food? And, you know, you can mark sometimes, or there's different specifications for each one. And what's great about that is, as opposed to like a food diary, which I know a lot of practitioners use, if I give you a food diary, you might just say like, yeah, chicken nuggets Monday through Friday, or like, you know, we bought carrots this week, so that's what they ate this week. So this gives us a big range as far as what the parent actually thinks they would eat if they were presented with it, and what those reasons are. So it'll go through the whole
food. Yes, that's huge. I'm sorry. Yeah. That's huge. Oh. I just have to say really quickly, because, you know, sometimes when you're doing food therapy, it's like, you know, we try with these certain things, but then if you're not keeping up at home, or the, like you said, the menu changes for mm-hmm. the next week, it's like, okay, now it's this season and oranges aren't in season. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so then we lose this gap of time because we're not eating oranges because they're not, or strawberries or whatever right. it is. I love this.
Yeah. So, yeah. And so then each food is scored to, generate a result. And so for instance, like, let's say you're like, my kid loves ice cream, so it must be that they like cold food, or it must be they like creamy food. But in reality, it might be that they like the mintiness of the mint ice cream they're eating. And then we notice the pattern of like, oh yeah, that sour, spicy, tangy, bitter, that's something they're really strong with. So you'll get all those sorts of results. And then as well, there's a behavioral breakdown too. So it goes through three different sections for social eating and eating compliance, eating related communication. So can they request food when that food is visible? Can they request food when the food is not visible? Can they appropriately reject food? All of those sorts of things. And then physiological and motor capabilities. So everything from like using utensils to can they serve themselves food? Can they swallow a vitamin, you know, things like that. So you'll also have an in-depth breakdown of behavior too that you can look at.
So they have to go to a website to download the PDF.
So you go to feedingassessmenttool.com. When you purchase within 48 hours, you'll receive your individualized link. And then when you log into that link, you just start taking the test, you know, whenever you're ready. And then when you finish the test, you'll automatically get your PDF generated.
Perfect.
Okay. And so this is not specific to you then?
Yes.
Is that my understanding? Or as a therapist, yes. Or can I mean?
Yeah. So you won't meet with me as a therapist. You do it on your own. If you have any questions, you're welcome to reach out. The email is contact@feedingassessmenttool.com. But the idea is that you can use this and then bring it to your therapist that you're already working with, that you already have a relationship with, and just use the information for your feeding therapy.
And so the clinicians themselves can also, they can purchase the tool to use for their practice. Do they have to purchase it individually for each kid every time, or can they just buy it to have the tool? How do you?
For parents, it's more than likely that you'll just purchase one. So we have that option of like a single purchase. But for clinics, we have clinics purchase in bulk. So you can obviously save a lot of money if you buy it by like the 100 and you get, it's just that same link. You have like a portal basically, and you get to run through 100 and then you can renew and get, you know, the link will continue to work for you, but it'll work for 100 more. We have all the way up to 500.
I love that. That's perfect because there's so many.
So awesome.
Like even, you know, I talk with my pediatrician at the visits and I always share all the new information that we get from guests that we have on the podcast and these resources, and they're like, oh my gosh, I need to know. Because they're hungry too for what are other resources that I can share with families to help them. And this is such a vital one. And that again, it has the option again to just take that and use that as information to provide to your teams. So to even Tasha's point, part of the interdisciplinary approach, I also had gotten our education team on board with the feeding therapies or protocols that we were doing so that they could implement them, you know, during the lunch or snack time, you know, so that because one of the biggest things that I saw also creating that demand avoidance that we were experiencing was behavioral contrast. And so when you have all these different entities doing things differently and changing the scope, like it was like, ugh, well, then I'm just not going to do this at all. You know, for him, he was like, nope, retreat, retreat, flight, flight, flight. I'm going out of here, man. Out. And there was more behavior than just that, but that's kind of what, you know, you're dealing with. And then that just fell into other things and then therefore shows up possibly as indicators of regression. And that's not really obviously. That's not getting to the heart of really what is, right? We're treating the symptoms of things and not actually what the root cause is. And so I love this so much. And thank you for your brain and thinking of such a wonderful tool that I can't wait to hear all the feedback that we're going to get even from this episode alone. Being like, oh my gosh, this tool is amazing. So glad you had her on. They're all going to use it. They're just going to be like, why was this hiding out this entire time?
That is the amazing part, I think, is that, you know, predominantly speaking, generally speaking, our predominant community is, parents that are listening, but we do get so many other listeners, whether it be therapists or, you know, family members, you know, maybe they're, you know, once removed from the neurodiverse child, whatever it might be, we get a gamut. And there are so many people that I think that could benefit from that. Even, I mean, it's not even just neurodiverse children or, you know, adolescents, young adults, whatever. I could use this on my typical daughter who
absolutely And can you use
basically
it on yourself
picked
as
up
well?
The same eating pattern as her brother because that, it's what her brother
that's
did.
That's what's happening at our house too. Well, Rory's getting to do this. Know. And I was like, you used to eat pate, jars of it. Okay. You ate meat off the bone like a savage prehistoric being. Like,
but I think that's what's so incredible is that, you know, this can even be for the parents out there that are just struggling, that their child is totally typical. Mm-hmm. They will not eat out of the, you know, beige realm, or they will not eat anything that is whatever, you know, it's so good. Can we put you on a little pedestal for a second?
I don't know if you remember, Tosh.
You guys can see the video. I'm holding her up here.
The entire time we're having this conversation, it just reminds me of when we had Renee on. And she was telling the story about how what they were dealing with feeding at home and sitting at the table. And that, like, obviously,
yeah, Renee Ingalls, yes.
It was her. She shared it also as her peak, but she was also, I remember just resonating with that feeling of that frustration that she was currently having. And they're like, well, this is our biggest challenge right now, you know? And I just want to be like, Renee, look what we found.
Yes.
You're going to love it.
I mean, because it does even too go down to that simple, you know, like to that part of, you know, maybe you do have a child who is, I don't want to use the word, but what would be considered higher functioning, you know, and you do have the capability to go sit down in a restaurant, but they even have their own struggles there because it's, you know, that their patience level gets, you know, runs out quickly. And so it's like figuring out just that, you know, like, I mean, we still have, you know, our children will sit down at the dinner table if they have an iPad in front of them. I don't even want to admit that.
Oh, but you just did.
but I just did, you know, and then watching them try to sit down and just eat as a family, it's almost like their bodies will not allow for it. And I'm like, I guess maybe because we all have ADHD in our house. Like, I don't know, but it's like, I mean, you know, they have to be like, you know, crouching down on their chair or walking around the table or whatever it might be. And it's like, these are things that I'm like, I'm sure this is not happening at school. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's like, how can we, so just all your whole assessment, bringing it all together is just so like,
oh, but it's my definitely happening at school for us for sure. What we call it.
Well, no, I know.
We call it flexible seating. Flexible seating arrangements.
Yeah. But there are the kids who, you know, like my son, Jack Elizabeth, he's always been really like peer example driven. So he just does whatever his peers are doing, you know, whatever his typical peers are doing and which has been great. But you know, and then it's like, you get into a different setting. You're not in school and it's like, you're at a restaurant or and you're like,
how
is this different?
That's the behavioral contrast. That's what I was referencing.
Yes.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yes. Yeah, so that's what you figure out.
He has not, I'm going to use the ABA term. He has not generalized the skill. Mm-hmm. And so the skills are not generalized. Mm-hmm. And so that's always the struggle. And so this used to be the fight that I used to have with, you know, being in school, because the education setting is the function of it is different than the functions of home or being in a restaurant, and all having to adapt to all those different functions of all those different settings. It literally drives you crazy as a parent.
Yeah.
And I'm not a BCBA, you know, and then I had to learn to basically be one, and I don't have those four letters behind my name. And it's very frustrating, especially after all these years that I don't have that.
Yeah.
But like, you know, and now I'm failing because I'm out of practice and haven't had ABA in like a year and a half. But still, like that is exactly it, Tosh. Like, that's exactly one of the problems and challenges that we have, and why we can't get our kids to increase at a higher frequency their food repertoire and also like feel comfortable doing that in all of those different areas, because we're having to mitigate all these different things. And we're not there all the time. Like, mind you, we're not at school. Like, we're not in the classroom with our kids. Mm-hmm. So
we don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. And so I do have to just ask Elizabeth, because you, I mean, you know, obviously you work with children that have the higher demands, of whether they're autistic or whatever it might be that they are in therapy for. But do you think, you know, there is this, just because that there is a change in just our societal, where we are so short, what's the word?
Delayed gratification?
Our attention span is just so, it's growing shorter and shorter and shorter. And it's just happening, you know, like even more with our kiddos, you know, again, whether they are typical or neurodiverse, whatever it might be. But does that play a part in that too? You know, I mean,
yeah, I definitely think,
does that make sense?
There's so many different factors at play. I think most of the time, I mean, not all the time, but a lot of the time, kids don't even just have the diagnosis of autism. They also have ADHD, right, and like other comorbid disabilities too. So you have to take those into account. And then we have, like you, right, were saying, the behavioral contrast, there's all these different environments. So there's so many things that could be at play. And yeah, the lack of the attention, mm-hmm, span is, mm-hmm, definitely one of them. Going back to the generalization, mm-hmm, you used a lot of good ABA terms there, Jean.
I know. Put me back in. Can I take the board now, please? I could use the money. I don't want to be in the clinic. I just want to be research-based BCBA. That'll be good for me.
Yeah. But the generalization is so huge. And that's something that I actually talk about a lot, especially if you're, if any parents are listening who are just like sort of entering into this, because kids with autism often get so fixated on a certain like routine and it has to be this certain way. Any small thing that you can change in their mealtime, it doesn't have to be drastic, but to avoid that rigidity is really important. So I always say, like, serve it on a different plate, serve it in a bowl, serve it in a cup. Even if it's a quesadilla, put it in a cup. Or, you know, flip it upside down, cut it into a heart. Do as much, mm-hmm, as you can to just have small, subtle differences so that they are open to a little bit of diversity on their plate is really, really important, because losing generalization, it's really hard to get it back. So if you can just maintain that at the beginning, even if it's just, you know, we cut it in half sometimes, we leave it whole other times, you know, do as much as you can to keep a little bit of variety.
I love that, because I mean, for somebody who never did ABA therapy, you know, I don't know any of that. I don't know anything, mm-hmm, about that. And it's, I wish I would have stopped peeling the apples and said, no, sometimes you get it this way. Listen to all these little things. It's like, if we could have just made these small changes, mm-hmm, you know, it's not saying that it would be perfect, but it's like, right, yeah.
Or even just handing him the apple upside down. You know, if you're not at a place where he would ever eat an apple peel, if you just hand him the apple upside down, or sometimes you take the stem out, you know, just those small things that make it a little bit different can start to build.
I'm just like having flashbacks, okay, of like so many instances right now, just so many targets. And like my son, his two infamous statements when he is protesting about something he doesn't like, it is, ooh, yuck. I mean, he's extended on that. It says, ooh, yuck, that's disgusting. The other day I gave him water without ice in it. And he was like, ooh, yuck, that's disgusting. Okay, same bottle. I went and put ice in it. And I was like, okay. And then he's fine. But sometimes even if I've corrected what he wanted within the container, it still is like, now the profile is ruined. Mm-hmm. He's now, that generalization is gone. And it's like, okay, we lost that. And it, especially after like I went out and like bought the bulk, I'm like, oh my God, he's eating this now. It's great. And now we're going to do these things and all these different variations. And then the one time I get the variation wrong and like, well, nope. And now I have a huge inventory of whatever cereal or whatever food item it is. I mean, like even peanut butter and jelly too. I mean, I'm like, I, so much of that, right? Like so much of what you said. I know that parents listening to this are literally probably in their cars or in their kitchen going, oh my God, that's my house. Or like, it's so much beyond just the, that's not on the right plate. And like the toddler tossing the, you know, the pink cup being like, I'm sorry, I wanted red today. Did you not, mm-hmm, understand? It's so much bigger than that. And then the other protest word was traitor. I don't even know where he got it from, but it was almost like this, And it was this, it's this rite of,
you're not on
it
my
is
team.
This rite of passage that we joke about it with the educational team. Like anytime there was like a new para that came on board or whatever. And I'm like, well, you're not in the circle of trust yet until you've made it to traitor status. Until you've gotten that protest, you now are in, because he's bold enough to say, you're a traitor. I know you'll still love me, but I'm saying no to this, you know? So it's just so funny. I mean, like I was so in it. I loved like you, you know, you became so enamored to the point that you created these profiles within this thing to literally dissect all the nuance down. Mm-hmm. That's really mm-hmm. incredible. I mean, and I'm sure mm-hmm. I'm just guessing, is that obviously as time goes on, if you have to go back and revisit the rubric or make adjustments that you will, or have you already done that since it's been launched, or what is?
No, I just launched it last year. So I haven't done the updates yet, but I'm more than happy to do them as they arise.
As you see that it may mm-hmm. fit. Like, I don't like, I guess other clinicians, if they'd give feedback or whatever, like you, or just they would converse with you or whatever you would call that information. I just find it so interesting because, again, there has not been a positive remedy or resource that, again, can serve in the function privately at home. Mm-hmm. And then in all these other different settings where, again, I can go back to the educational team, or we can go back to our, you know, our therapy providers and say, hey, I got this data here. Mm-hmm. What can we do?
Or we can just start right where we're at. Doesn't matter what age, doesn't matter how long we've had our diagnosis, that is, you know, whatever. Just
so, mm-hmm. so special and so good. And I look forward to seeing other things that you do, because the work is never done. Mm-hmm. Always doing new things. I'm sure you'll see other things that you, other gaps for sure. Like you said, I think that was another fascinating thing that I found out was, again, looking at the timeline. And I like to share this kind of stuff because I like parents to stay curious. We always say the most important thing you can do is stay curious about your child, curious about what they need, ways that you can help support them. But being curious also about the origin, about all these things, like, again, speech therapy, occupational therapy, those boards have been established for all those years. ABA being technically, to me, I considered being in its infancy, the same mm-hmm. thing that I felt with the IDEA in the educational realm. Like, it's still, to me, it's very much in the infancy. I think a lot of people now, especially as they come on board with their newly diagnosed child, I think they think these things have pre-existed for years, right? And they haven't. Mm-hmm. You're seeing this constant evolution of all of these systems that are all antiquated mm-hmm. together. I mean, like, literally, I mean, the ABA essentially is actually antiquated in so many things, even in speech and occupational and school, in our prison and police systems, like everything that we do behaviorally, it's all antiquated into that. So, you know, learning the history of that, I think, is helpful in trying to find, like, just identifying it and seeing it and then figuring out mm-hmm. what's right for your kid and how to figure out who's the right clinician too, like team mm-hmm. members, you know, or educators, and how well-informed they are. And that makes it, unfortunately, again, more overwhelming for the parent. I get that too, but this is a ever-growing, ever-learning process. And people like you who are now going, you know, that are putting dents in these systems in a way and significant benchmarks to really help families to propel them forward, I think is so crucial. We need more of you. We need more Elizabeths in mm-hmm. the world. Truly.
Thank you so much.
if you needed a boost today, we're here for it. Yeah. You're a superhero in our eyes. You might be one of my new favorite humans. I don't know if you're expecting that this kind of work, because this has been such a significant thing, you know, we don't realize it. And I think I also, in part of grief, which we talk about broadly on this podcast, it comes up all the time. Talk about things, a concept or a theme that's antiquated in many of our discussions. It is that there's a lot of grief around this, because it's mm-hmm. this food, eating and food is a basic need that touches everything in our lives as a human being. It is
the humanity around it. And so that is what I would leave with our community today. Anyone listening, is that if you are struggling with that, like, where we get it. Mm-hmm. We understand, like, we are your people. We are here. We mm-hmm. hope you find this helpful. And as a geeking out, excited as we are about it, and send us all your questions, and we will make sure that this information, how to, are you online as well? Do you have a platform online on social media?
I have a Facebook. Feeding assessment tool.
Yeah. Feeding assessment tool. And then they obviously go to feedingassessmenttool.com to pull and purchase the rubric, assessment, the assessment tool, so that they can. Mm-hmm.
And then any questions, my email's on there as well, so they can reach out if needed.
Great. Perfect.
Perfect.
Well, yeah. Thanks for being on with us today.
Thank you so much.
Loved it.
Yes. Yeah.
Tosh, any closing statements or questions?
Well, since I'm always the one that forgets, I will just remind everybody, if you can get on and give us a review, it helps us to build our platform, to reach more people, more parents like you, or anybody, more therapists. You know, we want therapists knowing this business that Elizabeth is sharing. So, yes. So you can find us on any major podcast player platform. And if you have specific questions for us, you can reach us at hello@momstalkautism.com. And you can find us on Instagram @momstalkautism. And that's it. Yeah.
Find us.
Thanks.
Yes.
Find us. Find Elizabeth. Find it all. Everything will be in the show notes.
Yes. And I made sure I wrote this down. So there's I'm not going to miss it. All right. Thank you so much for being on, Elizabeth. And we'll see everyone next time.
See you later.
Bye.